Hey, nurses! This National Nurses Week 2025, it's time to celebrate you, the backbone of healthcare, with a vacation you truly deserve. Join Nurse.com for a luxurious group cruise aboard Virgin Voyages, sailing May 9th through May 14th. It's a celebration like never before, designed exclusively for nurses. Picture this. Tranquil ocean views, world-class amenities, and the chance to connect with your nursing community while leaving the stress of long shifts far behind. Plus, when you join us, you'll receive $200 in onboard credit per cabin to enjoy spa treatments, premium excursions, merchandise, and more. You spend every day caring for others. Now it's your turn. Let's trade scrubs for sandals and sail into National Nurses Week with joy, connection, and well-deserved relaxation. Register now to join the group trip at nurse.com/cruise. That's nurse.com/cruise. We can't wait to celebrate you.
Welcome back for part two of this very special two-part episode with Dr. Rob McDermott.
I am kind of fascinated by AI and what AI is going to bring to the table for healthcare over time, because one of the things that I think would be fantastic is if it's like, hey, give me like 2 to 3 sentences about this patient's healthcare history before I walk into the room that I can refer to that will help to create confidence in my ability to provide care, you know? And
totally.
Can you imagine it like spits out for you? It's like, Mr. So and so has had 4 surgeries over the past 6 years and is currently struggling with congestive heart failure and has a wife who is his power of attorney, something like that, durable power
Absolutely.
Of attorney.
Yeah, there's actually a project going on in my health authority where we're working with an AI company and some big data organizations to create AI-enabled discharge summaries. So that's basically the same thing. Obviously, the challenge is going to be a garbage in, garbage out. And if you're being told to put glue on pizza and like the things I was just seeing in the news about the Google AI, you know, I don't know how we don't want it to be hallucinating. So we have to be very careful about
the integrity,
how it's used and the integrity of the data source. But on the flip side, I do think that there is the ability to summarize right, data that is put in front of them may be very, very beneficial. From the AI maybe allow us to synthesize information very quickly into a snapshot that gives us a starting point for how to engage with somebody in a more meaningful way. I'm kind of excited about that, to be perfectly honest, because I think that one of the challenges is now, where do we pay attention? It's the amount of information, the amount of data that we have on people is monumental, right? And the biggest part of my job is actually sifting the data for the information, trying to filter the noise from the signal, right? And so I want to know what the signal is, what is important to pay attention to in this really complex patient. If there's something that critical care is really good at, it's trying to get to the things that matter from a data standpoint. It's probably the most data-rich environment in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And yet the vast majority of it, some of them say, well, what do you think of this? And it's like, I often say, I ignore it. No, I haven't ignored it. I'm incorporating it into a plan. I feel that is of lower relevance than this other data, right? I never ignore anything, but you have to be able to put it into a hierarchy of what is really important, what's mission critical right now, and what are the other things that matter a little bit less, but are still important contexts.
Yeah. Establishing confidence and being able to just break through something very quickly so that you can do the other things, so that you can get to the art of medicine is so wonderful. And I know I've probably said this before, but when I was precepting nurses and they had not ever done something, they'd never put an NG tube in, or they had never placed a Foley, or it was their first time putting in an IV or something like that, they'd be like, well, what if the patient asked if I know how to do this and if I'm good at it and how many times have I done it or this and that? And so I would say, this is what you say. You say, you wouldn't believe how many times I've done this. And that's your answer.
I would hate to have to tell you
how many times I've done this. You wouldn't believe it. And then you just do it. So, you know, you create, you're not lying, but you are instilling confidence. And what you said earlier, being competent, because that's what people want. They want somebody who at least has the illusion of being competent. not in an unsafe way, but that they carry themselves and they, you know, you don't want to be like, I don't know, you know, shaking and being like, you know, I have to go, you know, but it's like, that's never going to work. They're going to be like, I need another nurse. I need another doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're very accurate in saying that it's not the illusion at all, but the way you carry yourself is very important. I've got this idea that I would love to work with somebody on, and I haven't found the right partner. If you're interested, so it's medicine as performance art, right? And so if you think about art as being, I've thought about this a lot, and you know, we have this dichotomy of art versus science. The science is the technical stuff, right? The data and the information, and we say that the art is the emotional stuff, the soft stuff that, you know, is really important. And old clinicians will be like, oh, it's all about clinical judgment. What we know very clearly is that if you rely on clinical judgment, standardization of stuff that should be standard, we can design therapies that are much more effective if we take some of the clinical judgment out of it. So at a population level, we can actually save more lives if we follow the science. Now, medicine isn't science. It's a whole bunch of experiments involving a single person. So we don't do science in the traditional sense because we're not going to be able to predict the future with science. What we're doing is science, medicine is always retrospective. I do something and I see if it worked rather than I'm doing something because this is going to be the outcome. So I think that there's a really interesting book called How Doctors Think by a woman named Catherine Montgomery. And she says that the dichotomy, it's a false dichotomy, art versus science. She said what it actually is practical reasoning. And I think that's a very true statement. The science is the foundation, right? We take science and it informs our practice. The art inspires our practice, and compassion motivates our practice. And so I actually think that the importance of the art part is that it inspires us to do the things that are hard, but we do the hard things with technical expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I think that coming back to the thing that I wanted to ask you and what I haven't found someone to do is I think the art part is really important, right? Because it's an experience that people have. You can have the technical quality, but the experiential quality drives a lot of the outcomes that we want to see. Do people believe in Canada, for example, universal public health care, right? If they don't have, using an analogy from Michael, if you don't have a whole bunch of rabid fans for it, you know, you're going to become irrelevant, right? We've got to have people who are loyal to the idea of medicine, that this is because it's meeting their needs. It's actually surprising them. And so when I approach patients, one of the things that I want to do is surprise them with kindness. They don't expect to be treated kindly. They expect to be treated competently. But if you surprise someone by doing something kind, they're like, hey, I didn't expect that, right? He got me a cup of coffee, right? Or, and you layer that on top of technical expertise, then you get people who are like, damn, you know, this healthcare system actually works. And so I think that if you come back to the idea of medicine as performance art, something that we can take from from actors and from the movie industry is that acting isn't fake behavior, right? Acting, real, like good acting, is authentic behavior in a manufactured environment. And so treating medicine almost as if you're on stage. So when you show up, what role am I playing? It's not, hey, I'm going to pretend to be compassionate here. It's what is my job? Who am I supposed to be? How am I supposed to interact? You know, what's my goal? And then how do I behave in a way that allows people to feel what I want them to feel? And so I think things like improv classes and some acting classes for healthcare professionals would actually do a lot, because you hear about doctors who are technically expert and they have zero bedside manner. I think bedside manner is performance art, right? And it's not, like I said, fake behavior. It's not performative. Mm-hmm. It's who am I being when I'm in the room?
Yeah, so you also need to be convincing. Totally. You need to be convincing. I mean, it needs to be convincing. And some of that is that you are, if you talk to people who are good actors, they will say that they had to tap into something inside of them that allowed them to relate in some way or to convey a certain feeling. So some of it is that, like, if you're going to walk into this room and the role that you're going to play in this moment is that you are going to be play the role of the advocate. You're going to be the advocate in this role. So you have to then look back on a time in your life where someone was an advocate for you. And how did that feel? And what did they do? And how did they behave? And so that you can channel those same qualities and so that you can do those same things. But it is like to what you're saying is like it is that is performative. It's not that it's not authentic. It's still authentic. It's just that you have had to get in touch with something in yourself in order to show that authenticity to someone else, which then does come across as convincing. It you know, they do feel convinced that you are this person. Mm-hmm. You are the advocate. You are the spiritual healer or whatever you are in the moment. Being a chameleon, people have asked me like over my career, they're like, how do you just, you seem to just go into these different scenarios and kind of assimilate to where you're going. And maybe it's someone's house, maybe it's a patient's room, but it is, I think, being willing to kind of pause, take notice of your surroundings. Also, like, how do you, what are you picking up on? What are you feeling in there? Mm-hmm. Does this seem tense? Are people not talking to each other? Is no one smiling? Are people all looking at their phones? Are they all distracted? You have to look and then read the room. And that does kind of inform how you're going to, the role you're going to play. And you kind of have to be able to do this.
And if you want to be effective,
rather quickly,
you need to be able to, like you said before, meet people where they are. And if where they are, and by reading the room, you then figure out, okay, how do I shift the behavior? What behavior do I need to embody to shift the way they're feeling to the way I hope that they need, or the way that I believe they need to feel in order to, you know, process this situation most effectively. So I think there's some real value in being very self-aware when you walk into a room, being aware of your environment. And that comes back to something that you mentioned a long time, that we talked about a long time ago in the, already, was that there needs to be time and space for that. So if you're going into the room task-oriented, you don't have that open awareness of what's going on. And that's when you create catastrophe for yourself that ends up being, you know, you end up spending hours trying to undo the damage by unintentional communication. Someone told me you never don't communicate. The question is whether you're communicating intentionally or unintentionally, right? So when you show up in a room, are you communicating intentionally or is everyone around you just collateral damage? So by being very intentional with the way you're behaving and being very clear on your goal. And then the third part is being courageous and not being self-conscious about, oh, am I doing the right thing? You have to know what you're doing. You have to be confident. You don't need to be overconfident and you don't need to be certain. In fact, I think certainty is very problematic because I'm not certain of anything. I can be quite confident in something, but once I'm certain, I'm almost invariably wrong, So,
yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. I have learned that in when people.
If I'm certain about something, it's that. Certain, every time I'm certain, I'm wrong.
I know. Yeah. That always used to happen for me when people are like, how long does my father have? And I'm like, I don't have a crystal ball. And that is what I know. Mm-hmm. And I know that every time I think I have an idea of when someone is going to pass, they usually prove me wrong. Mm-hmm. They usually hang on longer than I thought, or they'll leave sooner than I thought. And, you know, there's things that I can show you. There's things that I can look to indicate that the body is going through certain transitions. whether their mm-hmm. skin is mottling or their extremities are becoming cold, or there's, you know, there's just things that you can start to see very objectively that can start to lead you in a certain way. But it's okay to not be certain. And sometimes people are a lot more, they trust you a lot more when you, this goes back to what you said earlier, honesty, just being honest mm-hmm. and saying, I know how important it is that you know when this is going to happen and you want to be here. You don't want to miss it. You don't want to leave to go to the bathroom and something happens, and or you just decide you're going to leave for the night and that's when they end up passing. I know that it's really mm-hmm. important, and I wish that I could give you more specificity in this. But unfortunately, people go when they're going to go. And yeah. there isn't a way for us to truly know, you know, when that's going to happen. And when you can do yeah. it with a sense of like saying out loud what you think they're thinking, because if you've been doing it long enough, you know what people are thinking. You do.
Yeah.
You've been around the block a minute. Like, you know, like you're like, okay, like they, you know, they're yeah. afraid that if they go to the bathroom or if they get up and go downstairs to the cafeteria and get some food, you know, that this is going to be the moment
they're going to miss it.
Yeah. They weren't going to be there for their last breath. And so you instill some sort of confidence that they're going to go when they feel ready to go. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is when we're not in the room. And that's okay too. It's hard for you because you want to be here, but this yeah. is how death and dying unfolds sometimes. And sometimes they can't do it when you're here.
Yeah. And I think, sorry, what I was going to say, one of the things that I find very interesting is that the few times in my life when I've been certain, I have been wrong, but people don't believe you. They want certainty, but when you give them certainty, they don't actually believe you. And when you're human about it, right, then they actually are much more trusting because mm-hmm. when you say, this is what's going to happen, they're like, Dr. McDermott, you said this was going to happen and it didn't happen. And I knew, right? So I usually say, here's my best guess. This is how I see it happening based on my experience. But coming back to the idea of certainty and hope, I had this experience one time I had a patient who came to me after a cardiac arrest, and he had this advanced directive on his chart that he didn't want to be resuscitated. He was a 65-year-old guy, was pretty healthy. He had cancer, but he had a not for resuscitation. And he had what's called a pulmonary embolus. I know you know what that is, but for your listeners, it's a blood clot that goes to the lungs, and it stopped his heart. And in response to that, the team in the hospital actually overrode his advance directive saying not to resuscitate him because he had a whole bunch of family there who said, even though he didn't want it, his sister was flying home from Africa and her plane had just touched down and he would want to see her. So they overrode his advance directive, and I thought, okay. And the hospital where it happened didn't have an ICU. So I was getting a phone call to say, hey, we've got this patient who was not for resuscitation, who we just resuscitated, and now we need to transfer him to you because his family overrode his... And I thought, oh my God, this is all bad. So I accepted him in transfer because I wanted to help the family come to terms with it. And it was just not the right time now that the traumatic experience had already happened. Now it was time to manage it. And so he showed up on my doorstep in the ICU, and I talked to his family and I said, I know he had an advanced directive. I know there's a family member that's on their way. What you don't need to do is worry about the process. We will manage the process. And I said, tell me a little bit about, you know, about him. I'm taking over his care now, and I need to know who he is. And that's how I actually open a lot of my conversations. Like, I get them to tell me about the person that's in the bed, because that shows that I'm interested, and I am interested. And that information helps me decide, how am I going to manage all the technical stuff? But they said, oh, you know, he's had cancer and he never wanted to be put on life support. And I was like, oh, okay. So has he, you know, what did he do for a living? And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, before he got sick. And they said, oh, he's still working. Okay. what did he like to do for fun? I said, oh, he likes to golf. I said, does he, you know, do 9 or 18 holes? And what does he like to do? I don't golf, but like, I just asked questions about it. And I said, you know, when he golfs on the golf course, does he use a golf cart? And they're like, no, he walks 18 holes. He does it every Sunday. And I was like, that's odd. And I thought, does he have any pain? And they said, no, he has no pain. And I was like, why didn't he want to be resuscitated? Like, pardon my ignorance, but he had no pain. He's still working. He still enjoys life. Like, his quality of life okay? And they're like, oh yeah, it's great. And I said, so why didn't he want to be resuscitated? And they said, well, because when his mom got sick, he was put on life support, and they asked him if they could remove the life support. They asked him for his permission to remove the life support and put the burden of responsibility on him to decide to stop treating her. And he told us that he never wanted us to be put in that situation. So he never wanted to even entertain the idea of being put on life support, even though this guy had a great quality of life, pain-free, and had cancer that was actually causing no symptoms.
Wow.
So I thought, oh my God, like, okay, so now we're in a different situation.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, okay, so this guy has a bad brain injury because he's now had a cardiac arrest. He's unconscious. The family is coming, and everybody is talking about not, you know, it's time for him to die. So I ended up telling the family that the person that came from overseas landed and came to the room. She said, I believe in miracles and he's going to live. And I said, I have no way of knowing how this is going to play out. This is what I see. I have a lot of information that suggests that he is going to not be all right. And I am going to take him off the life support because those were part of his wishes. And right now things look pretty bleak. I said, but one thing I'm going to be very careful of is I'm not going to create a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm not going to sedate him into oblivion. One of the things that he wanted and you want as a family, and I'd learned this been talking to them, that they wanted to be able to see if they could talk to him, right? Or at least share with him. So I said, I will give him something for pain so that he doesn't suffer, but I will not end his life with medication. And I just don't feel comfortable with that. And I never have felt comfortable with that. I allow the body to take its natural course. And I am very good at relieving suffering, but I don't end people's lives with medication. It's against the ethical principles that we practice under. So the family, I said, we're going to do this at 3 o'clock. And so the family ended up going down for a cup of coffee. And at 2:55, before they got back, he kind of opened his eyes and was a little bit, he was a bit agitated. He started coughing. He had a breathing tube in his throat. And so he started coughing and freaking out. And I thought to myself, oh no, if I don't take this tube out right now, even though I've negotiated with the family that I'm going to do it in 5 minutes and they're not here, he's going to have to be resedated. And then I'm not going to be able to do the thing that I said I was going to do. So I pulled his tube out 45 seconds before they walked in the room. And so I shattered the trust that I had with the family by acting in what I thought was his best interest, because they said, you said you were going to wait for us to be here. They walked in as we'd pulled the tube out. And so I thought, this is all bad. So the whole situation was completely chaos. But I said, no, we had to do it. I had to make a decision in his interest to follow his wishes and then allow you to have the experience that you wanted. And the timing didn't happen. That was the certainty part of things. And I said, now we're just going to watch and wait. And he didn't die. He ended up breathing okay. And we moved him off to a palliative care ward. And a couple of days later, I actually connected with the family and they were very grateful. Once the anxiety of the moment settled down, they were very grateful that I'd done what I did. And they said they understood. And they were glad that I did the extubation when I did, because they were able to, you know, at least be with him a little bit. Went up 3 days later and started to rouse a little bit. And he was kind of in and out of consciousness. And then they're like, okay, well, he's been sick in hospital for a week. We're going to move him home. And as it turned out, about 7 or 8 months later, a home care nurse showed up at his house to give him a bath. And door opened, and she said, hi, I'm here to give Mr. Smith a bath. And he looked at her and he said, you're very young and pretty, but I think I can manage a shower on my own. That was 7 years ago. The guy's still alive. I get a Christmas card every year. He completely blew my mind in terms of everything that I'd anticipated. He actually, he's back working. He's golfing. He's like, I was completely wrong, right? And so this, the reason I tell you this story was that I was certain he was going to die, but I didn't create a self-fulfilling prophecy of ensuring that he died. And what I allowed myself to, and allowed him to do, was be surprised by something that I didn't expect, that was positive, that I couldn't have predicted. And so by allowing the uncertainty to be there, his sister, who came from overseas, was totally right. She believed in miracles, and I have an operational definition of a miracle. It's something that I didn't expect, that I can't explain, that people generally agree is pretty darn good. So it doesn't have to be religious, but I've seen that all the time. Could I anticipate this happening? Not a chance. Did I allow it to unfold? 100%. Right? If I can take any credit for it, it was for not being certain and being comfortable, being uncomfortable, as you so eloquently said, and allowing the journey to unfold in the way it needed to unfold, in a way that ultimately was good. And the irony in it for me was that if I hadn't been so comfortable with the uncertainty, I would have said, damn, like, the guy lived when I was certain he was going to die. Like, why would I ever want to be so certain that a good outcome becomes something that is actually embarrassing for me, right? It was, or becomes something that I'm trying to fight against. So by allowing myself that opportunity to be uncertain and to embrace the moment, I was pleasantly surprised by something that I didn't expect, that the family appreciated, and I was wrong, but I wasn't in error. I was in error, but I wasn't wrong. Pardon me.
Yeah.
So my prediction didn't come true, and I want to be wrong. I don't want my patients to die. I want them to survive and have a good quality of life. So if I'm wrong when I say that someone is very likely to die, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to push onto families, is this idea that your job is to be hopeful, and we'll just see how this plays out.
Yeah. Attention, amazing travel nurses. Discover Court Furniture Rental for stress-free furnishing solutions. Perfect for those always on the move, Court, spelled C-O-R-T, delivers and sets up furniture, housewares, and electronics nationwide in just 48 hours. With Court, moving is easy. Choose from curated packages or pick up items to suit your style. When it's time to move on, Court handles it all. There's an exclusive offer, too. Use code NURSE15 at checkout for 15% off your monthly lease. Valid for travel nurses only. Visit court.com/nurse. That's CORT.com/nurse to get started today. With Court, the more you lease, the more you save. Terms and conditions apply. See the website for details.
What a beautiful story. I was just literally like on the edge of my seat. I was like, what is going to happen to this guy? You know, so I could not.
I couldn't believe it. I honestly couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it.
I can't believe it either. I mean, like, and I've kind of seen some stuff too, where I was like, I didn't know that was going to happen, you know, like, and it's
totally,
like you said, of course you're pleasantly surprised. And the more you see, the more humble I think you are willing or able to be, because you don't want to be in one of those situations. It's super uncomfortable to be in a situation where you double down on something and you're like, look, you know, like I'm gonna muscle you into believing, you know, or just submitting to this, because in some way, you know, I need to get you to a place of acceptance or I need you to understand what is happening so that I can, you know, move forward. Mm-hmm. And probably some of the best stuff in my career has been some of the most surprising. And it really has now probably put me into a position where I will help people get to a place of comfort, right? Like, it used to be really hard for me to watch a family struggle. And there was an element of suffering involved when I would watch parents whose child was at the end of their disease. And everything had really shut down at that point. And so it's hard. And sometimes I'd say, you know what? I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I medicate for the patient and sometimes I medicate for you. And it's because you're having a hard time seeing these gasps of air, this agonal breathing, this, you know, some of the stuff that is relatively difficult to watch at length. And so I'm going to give some stuff that I think is going to help with air hunger. I'm going to give a little bit more Ativan, you know, to help with a level of disconnection so that I can say, look, you know what, your child, this is a physical thing that's happening right now, but they are not, I have given enough medication at this point that they're not feeling any of this. This is just, this is
discomfort,
this is
no
mechanical.
Yeah.
Okay. This is mechanical breathing. This is something that's happening from the brainstem. This is, you know, like, this is not them struggling. This is going to have to, and especially with children, because children's bodies are strong. Their hearts are strong. Their bodies are strong. Their life force is strong. And so it takes time sometimes for them to transition. And that is a really, really hard thing. And over my 17 years of doing this, it's probably only been in the last 5 to 7 years that I have felt like I was able to get to a point where I'm like, okay, now I feel like I can just help and hold space for the family and I can help them get through this, because we have to let the body go and the body is going to take its time. And now I just have to shift my focus over to them. And now I'm caring for them. And it's a challenge. It's not easy, but this again goes back to the art of medicine, because at that point, I'm not really doing anything medical anymore. Yeah. I had a family.
Is that sitting with
Yeah,
people?
I had a family just recently say to me, I got called to a house. A friend of mine called me to a house and said, my friend's longtime boyfriend is dying. He's been on hospice for a period of time. He was in a lot of denial, didn't want to take the medication, didn't want to take the morphine, didn't want to take anything. His girlfriend was trying to convince him to take it. He didn't want to take it. And now he is unresponsive at this point. He's on the couch and he's kind of like in a compromised position and he's unresponsive. And my friend is freaking out. She said, could you go? And she just happened to not be too far from me, like, you know, probably about a couple miles away. This was like a Sunday morning. I walked in. Sure enough, this guy is like practically hanging off of the couch, 1 foot kind of like hanging off. You could tell that someone had tried to adjust him, but he was heavy. And so I came in and I was like, first, we're going to get him comfortable. Then I'm going to sit down and we'll talk about what's happening. But first, we're going to get him to a place of comfort. Okay. And so I'm like, okay, you're going to do this. I'm going to do that. We're going to move him. And this is how we're going to move him. And we moved him and we propped him and we did the whole thing. And then I sat down on the couch next to her. And apparently this is what I do. I take my shoes off. It's a thing. I don't know. I've done it for a long time, not in the hospital. Let's be clear. Let's be clear. This is in home environments only. But I take my shoes off. It's like a grounding thing for me. And I will oftentimes sit cross-legged. And so we went in and we just started talking. At this point, there's not anything that I'm doing for him. He's out, you know, he's breathing, you know, he's apneic, but he's breathing and it's just time. Like, this is just time at this point. And so I sat with her and it was like probably a couple hours. And then finally, like, he took his last breath and, you know, she was there and a sister had come and now she was there. And we called the hospice nurse. She was on her way. And then I was just like, okay, the hospice nurse came and I was like, okay, you're in good hands. She's going to take care of everything from here. And if you need anything, you know, feel free to let me know. And I left. And a while later, she reached out to a friend of mine, the friend who had called me, and said, she literally verbatim was able to tell my friend everything I had said in that moment. Like she literally, I was like, oh yeah, that is something I would say. Oh yeah, that's that sounds like me. Like she was like literally like she had hung on to every single word I had said. She even said she came in, she took her shoes off, she was sitting cross-legged on the couch. She knew everything. Like she like painted the picture for my friend.
Wow.
Because that's what matters to people. They hang on to that stuff.
It's being totally present. You're totally present.
Totally.
It sounds like it was just.
Yeah, totally present.
It sounds like you were totally present. Yeah. And that's what I think is so great about precious gift that both of us have in looking after people, that if you, once you've done it for enough time, the technical stuff gets pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And I won't say it's not simple, but it's straightforward. It's the presence and the being able to do it with your eyes closed if you have to, that having that skill to be able to do the technical part while paying attention to all of the stuff that's going on around you so that you can manage the environment and make it a safe space for people while you're doing this really difficult thing that people freak out about, right? Yeah. It's understandable that they freak out. It's scary. But to be able to have the confidence to say, here's what we're going to do first, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to talk. I mean, that's just absolutely beautiful. And what I hope to embody when I'm with patients, just like you, it sounds like you did there. That's a beautiful story.
Oh, well, it's not even close to your story. The guy that was alive all these years later. I'm like, what?
I know. I got a Christmas card this year from him in December 2023. Like it's 7 years. And I thought to myself, oh my God. And they always say, you know, here's another year and we're so grateful to you. And I think to myself, like, I didn't do anything here. All I did was take his tube out and he did all the hard work, but you're giving me all the credit. So it's amazing.
No wonder you're not like, you're like, I can't help people die. I'm sorry, because there's a guy who's still alive 7 years later and I can't do it.
I've told this story so many times and it's like, it's mind blowing. And the reason I find it so important is the thing that I've found. And what I think your story really emphasized for me is this idea that there's so much stuff to do in medicine, right? And it's at that moment when there's no more stuff left to do that you just have to sit and be present with the suffering. And I had that experience. I did a TED talk TEDx talk a couple of years ago. And in my TEDx talk, I actually talk about watching a person die. And it was in the moment of sitting with them while they died and not having anything left to do other than be present that I truly felt like a physician, like a doctor. Right? That's when I understood what it meant to be a doctor. It's not the science stuff. It's not distracting myself with tasks like, you know, flicking the IVs or adjusting oxygen tubing or trying to give a medication. It is just being there and holding a hand and being present with the suffering, shouldering a little bit of that burden and allowing people around you to know that things will be okay. Even though they're not okay, they will be okay.
Yep.
One phrase that I've heard a lot is, things happen for a reason. Maybe, but I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. I've seen a lot of really bad things happen to some really good people. But what I am sure of is that people make meaning out of difficult situations, right? And it's not the meaning that is inherently present in an event. It's how you interpret it in the context of your life and what you do with that experience that is where the meaning comes from. And I think that's a lot more powerful, to be honest. How you create an environment for people to make their own meaning out of a situation that is traumatic allows them to create some kind of transcendent legacy from a traumatic experience. The death of a child, your experience with dying children, very different than my experience with dying adults, dying parents. Most of the time, my parents are older that I see. With the toxic drug crisis in Canada and in BC, I do think that we are seeing more children die. And so death of a parent, you're losing your past. Death of a child, you're losing your future. That's a very different consequence for someone. And so for me, being able to take this thing that is extremely traumatic and allow someone to see the beauty that might be in it, even though it's extremely difficult, and then take that little kernel of something beautiful and carry that forward with them into a legacy that they can tell, a story that they can tell about how this unfolded in a way that allows them not to be devastated by it. That's where I get the most value for myself. And it's what makes me want to get up and go back to work every day. If I can find that little yep. thing that allows someone to just flip the switch and say, this horrible thing, maybe just a little less horrible than I thought it was, because now they're comfortable, or now they're not suffering, yep. or their pain has been eased, or people care, or something, right? It's looking for that little thing that flips the switch.
Yeah. And you know, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I was like, this made me think of something, and now I have to say it.
Sure. Absolutely.
Now I have to say it to you. Okay. So I was just talking to a longtime friend of mine. And this was probably about, 6 years ago or so. I had a couple of margaritas at our friend Mike's house and got challenged by...
Some spicy margaritas.
Got challenged by his niece to do a cartwheel. And so Ella was like, you could do a cartwheel with me. I was like, I can do a cartwheel. And so I tried to one up it, and I tried to do a round off, which I should not have done at almost 40. But at the time I was almost 40. So I was like, I broke my ankle, my right ankle.
Oh no.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. In fact, Lanny was like, oh, he heard the sound, the crack, the whole thing. I mean, he was like, what was that sound? And I'm like, that was my ankle. And I just kind of like,
that would be bones.
Just
that
crumpled would be bones. To the floor. And it was St. Patrick's Day. And so my wife takes me home, and I, like, you know, I try to medicate myself. That didn't work. Ended up in the hospital. Anyway, whole thing. Fast forward, I now have a cast on my right foot, and so I can't drive a car. So I had to take a lift to take my son to school. Okay. Which I would not normally have been doing. I would have driven. So I take a lift to school. And when I come out from dropping him off, I of course then have to call another lift to leave. So I'm standing out in front of the school when I would not normally be standing out in front of the school, but here I am standing there because I'm waiting for a lift. My friend, whose daughter, who has optic pathway glioma, went to the same school as my son. She has lost most of her sight because of it. And she was running back in because Sophie had dropped her water bottle. And so here we are, we meet. We see each other and we meet. And I'm like, hey, how are you? What's going on? And she's like, oh my gosh. She's like, well, she goes, long story short, but I'm in the middle of trying to do these clinical trial things. And I had a lab set up for Sophie's tumor, and they were going to give me some of the tumor, and I was going to take it to this lab, and we were going to do some clinical trials and some testing and stuff like that. And the lab fell through. She's like, you don't happen to know anybody who owns a lab, do you? Or runs a lab? I said, that's really weird that you say that, because actually I do know somebody who runs the lab at UCLA. Let me see if I can connect you. It's Dr. Jewett. So I send a message to Dr. Jewett, and ping, she pings me right back and says, of course, I'd be happy to help. And I said, oh my gosh, there you go. I was like, and there you go. I don't know what's going to happen, but there you have it. Flash forward 7 years. They are actually now saving lives. The attending who used to be at CHLA, Dr. Finley, who is world-renowned for Head Start therapy for brain tumors, is now going to be her medical director as of yesterday. They are literally starting to, the very things that they discovered in that lab all those years ago. And then apparently when she started her business, and she did not know, she started it on St. Patrick's Day 2 years ago. Really? And it just so happened that the start of her business was on the very same day that I broke my ankle 6 years ago, which put me smack dab right where I was supposed to be, I guess. And now look at everything that unfolded.
That's crazy.
So it's like, yeah, you don't know You don't know how things are going to.
That's the beauty of uncertainty, right? That's the it's and things aren't inherently good or bad either, right? They're just
they just are.
And we will see, right? We will see how they turn
out. Unfold.
I think that, I think it's really important that we try not to pass judgment too often on whether something qualifies as good or bad, because it's all in the eye of the beholder. And the things that you take away from something, the learnings that you have, I think. There's a quote, and I wish I could remember who said it, but the world favors the opportunity. Fortune favors those who prepare their, spend their lives preparing for it. Right. So I think being prepared for opportunities, being open and aware, and being compassionate and thoughtful, just that's the kind of message that we want to spread. That's the societal message that we want to share. Yeah. With all of the chaos that's in the world right now, maybe at least healthcare can be a last vestige of decency, because we're dealing with suffering in such an acute way. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I would love to see is if at least we can be kind and compassionate in healthcare, maybe some of the polarization and rhetoric that we see in society will abate a little bit. It's an uphill battle. It's an uphill battle for sure. But if we don't maintain it in healthcare, I don't know where it's going to stay. I don't know where it's hospice maybe, but I consider hospice part of that healthcare spectrum. Yep. If we don't do it in the caring specialties and the caring professions, then it runs the risk of disappearing completely. So in my administrative role, I think we have to be absolutely laser focused. You look after the people that are looking after the people, right? If we can treat each other with kindness and compassion as an organization, then our care providers or healthcare providers will actually look after people in a way that is compassionate. And then maybe that message will spread to the rest of society.
And it does.
I think we're at a tipping point.
Yeah.
Right
and
now.
It does. It absolutely does. And I think it is our duty. It's our responsibility. We have to do it. If we don't do it, it is, I think, going to be lost in some capacity. And so
I'm very hopeful. Hopeful that we can do it, because I think that every time I go to work, it's every interaction is an opportunity to improve someone else's life just slightly. Right? And that's the approach I try to take with conversations. Even when my pager goes off, my phone rings, I'm like, ah! It's like, deep breath. Hello. Yeah. Right. It's just, I don't want that carryover of stress to contaminate the next interaction I have with someone. It's a new interaction. I have to remember who I am, what role I'm playing, and set people up for success. Yeah. Be compassionate. Relentlessly compassionate.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Rob, you're one of my favorite people.
Well, I love talking to you. I love talking to you too.
I know. Mike always says, he's like, oh, Dr. Rob said this, and Dr. Rob said that. And I was like, that's because Dr. Rob is awesome.
Well, you're very flattering. Oh. And I love talking with you. This has been a huge privilege to be part of your podcast.
Thank you so much.
I'd love to come back again sometime and talk about other things.
Absolutely.
It's a lovely experience.
Oh, well, thank you so much,
Rob.
Thank
you for making it a safe space for me.
Of course.
Thank you for making it a safe space for me to talk.
Of course. All right. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And I'll talk with you soon.
Okay. You take care.
Bye, Rob.
Bye-bye.
If you're a nurse or nursing student that enjoyed this episode, visit us at nurse.com/community,
where you can find the Nurse Dot Discussion Group, a place where we dissect each episode in detail and delve deeper into today's topics. Nurse Dot is a Nurse.com original podcast series. Production, music, and sound editing by Dawn Lunsford. Production coordination by Rhea Wade. Additional editing by John Wells. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to the Nurse Dot Podcast. Until next time, keep spreading the love and the care.